Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis, and believe it or not, don't get nervous. It's sunny outside. There's no snow, but that's tomorrow. It's going to snow here in America tomorrow, and if anybody would like to prevent that from happening, we won't stop you. And we are very excited. We have one of my favorite authors that has written. She's almost done with her 19th book, and in Detective Superintendent of Special Crimes Larimer is going to be in the 19th book in the series that she's two-thirds of the way through. And Alex Gray is here, and this book started off with a huge explosion in nearby rural Stirlingshire. As the opening ceremony for the games drew ever closer, the police desperately seek the culprits for who particularly did this. The Commonwealth Games are coming. And this book really kept me on my toes. So I'm going to read you what Kirkus wrote, an excellent procedural in which Gray does for Glasgow what Ian Rankin did for Edinburgh in the annals of crime fiction. Coming from Kirkus, that's a big one, big deal, because lately I've been reading Kirkus, and I don't know. And Gray has no equal when it comes to what she writes. How about that? So, Alice, good morning, and I am ready when you are.
Good morning, Fran. Well, here in Bonnie Scotland, I'm awfully sorry, but the snow has finally melted, the sun is shining, and my daffodils are blooming in the garden.
We have the saddest looking trees in the world. And I happen to love trees a lot. And the trees here look very pale. There's no leaves on them. And for my next book that I'm writing, which is going to be called Katie and Max, my grandmother's story in a concentration camp, the trees are perfect because they look sad and they have no leaves. So that's so sad.
Spring is going to come. So it will come soon. It always does.
I hope so. So everybody wants to know, how did you create Larimer, who I love, and his rise to becoming Detective Superintendent of Special Crimes? At the start of the novel, tell us about that explosion that I could feel happening as it was happening.
Well, do you know, it's really interesting that we should be having this conversation right now, mm-hmm. Fran, because the book mm-hmm. takes place in 2014, and that was the year that Glasgow in Scotland hosted the Commonwealth Games. And as you know, mm-hmm. it happens every 4 years, and right now it's happening in Australia, in their Gold Coast. Mm-hmm. So the Commonwealth Games only just started yesterday again, and a lot of people are looking back to what happened 4 years ago. Well, I can talk about the explosion. In the book, of course, this is a fictional explosion, but it really mm-hmm. did happen. Many years ago, mm. you may have heard that there was a terrorist plot to blow up Glasgow International Airport. Mm-hmm. And this actually did happen. Two men of Eastern origin tried to blow up the airport, and they were thwarted. However, forensic scientists discovered that they had had a dummy run, a dry run, if you like, and they had actually detonated a bomb out in the countryside. I found this out from my police and my forensic contacts. It wasn't something known to the public. And I squirreled this little fact away. So when I came to write the book, I thought, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to use that location where that dry run bomb took place, when it detonated away out in the countryside. And, you know, nobody knew. If they heard a bang, they might have thought it was a low-flying jet. They might have thought it was gunfire, people maybe doing practice shots, whatever. But the forensics found that this is where it was, and they linked it to these two terrorists who tried to blow up our airport. So that's really where that particular beginning of the novel came from.
Wow, that was really... I had a feeling, because you know me, when I do a book, I look up the stuff. So I knew that you were right on point. I knew, I read about it, and I'm saying, oh my God, this really happened, and it's happening now everywhere. When they had the Olympics in South Korea, I cringed the whole 2 weeks. I'm going like, I hope nobody decides to blow up North South Korea during this time.
I know.
But I guess the person opposite him was there, so they were pretty safe, unfortunately.
Yeah, can you imagine the kind of tension that the security forces must have and the security services
yeah.
must have when a huge, huge thing like that is put on? I mean, it must be a logistical and security nightmare. And, of course, that was one of the challenges for me. When my daughter asked me, before I wrote the book, when my daughter said, "Mum, what are you going to write next?" I said, "Well, I've got this idea about a plot to blow up the opening ceremony of the Commonwealth Games." "Mum," she said, "you can't do that." What did I say to her? "Watch me."
Mm-hmm.
So I did. Yeah, she thought this was maybe a step too far. But no, I thought this would be a really tense thing to do because, you know, our queen, Queen Elizabeth II, she was going to be there opening the Commonwealth Games. So it was a big moment. And to actually, you know, to write a book that was going to be published 2 or 3 months before the event, it was,
scary.
I suppose, a bit of a risk. However, you've read the book, Fran. You know what happens.
I can't tell anybody what happens because we can't give it away because they have to read
you
this.
You can't give it away. No spoilers in this show.
No spoilers on the show. No spoilers in my review. I try not to be anyway, given the spoilers. Yeah, I think that only happened once, and I said to the person, "Uh-oh, I didn't realize it." And, you know, that I wouldn't do that. And I don't write negative reviews either because it's not my place to say the book is not good. I just won't review it. I just toss it in and give it away to the people in my building pile. That's all. Actually, to be very honest, your book is staring at me, and they don't know who's getting it next. My cousin just called me. That was why. She heard you were on my show, so she wants the book when I see her. This is really
pleasure.
Amazing.
Well, I hope she enjoys it, Fran.
She better, otherwise she'll be sorry. She won't get any more. What can I tell you? So there's a second part to this book, which I really thought was cool, and I thought my guy William Larimer was going to get in trouble. How come you included his high school reunion, of which I've never gone to one because I really didn't want to?
Yeah, it just seemed to be a personal angle. I thought, you know, what if he goes along to a high school reunion, meets his old flame, and, you know, there's maybe something disturbing going to happen there. And, you know, this is a girl he fell in love with at high school, but they parted. She went off to become an actress, to go to drama school, and he eventually went to university, but he gave it up to join the police. And well, how would he feel after all these years beating her again? You know, how would you feel if you met somebody that you'd loved when you were just a kid? And I thought it would be quite interesting to see how he would react and to show the reader the human side of him, not just his working side. But, of course, there's far more to it because this woman has a hidden agenda. And when she discovers, when her husband is found dead and she is in a terrible state, he actually invites her to live with him and Maggie while the police investigation is going on, this newly widowed woman. And so you have this ménage à trois, Maggie, Lorimer and Vivian. And it's a very uneasy and tense kind of time. And it does show quite a lot of Maggie and her character, too.
I don't think I would have been as tolerant. Seriously.
Mm.
I mean, yeah. I don't know.
It's a difficult one. It's a difficult one. You're dealing with somebody who's newly bereaved.
Yeah.
And, you know, her natural sympathy is showing. You know, how difficult must that be when your natural inclination is to sympathize and to show, hospitality and friendship, and yet inside you're churning because you think this woman is coming on to your husband. You know, it was a difficult
I got it. You know, it's funny. I won't say who, but I was at a specific event and an author came over to me and said, "Can I do an interview with you?" And then his wife came over and said, "What do you want with him?" I go, "Nothing. I just want to do, he wants to set a date for an interview." She had a canary fit. I was like,
"Gracious."
I cracked up laughing. I thought it was probably one of the funniest things that ever happened.
Yeah,
and I was
I
like,
think
I don't
well.
even know
Oh,
him.
dear.
I never met him before. And then
Oh,
the following
bless.
year, he came up and said, I don't want you to review my book. My wife doesn't want me to. And I go, not a problem. I got 100 more. And then his publicist didn't understand why I told him. I explained why. I didn't know whether to laugh or cry. I thought it was absolutely
Oh.
hilarious.
Oh, dear, oh,
What could
dear.
you do? What can I say? So
Well,
from
poor
the
guy,
start,
that's his loss.
yes, that's true. That's true. And I think it's just her in general. She needs to get a grip on life or something. But from the start, we know that there's something sinister about Vivian. And she wants
Yes.
to connect with Larima in more than one way. So when does he realize that she's got in her mind? And why doesn't Maggie smack her in the head?
Do you know, it's all a matter of evidence. You can sense
Yeah.
that there's something not quite right,
Yeah.
but evidence does turn up. And when the evidence is there, that is when you really do know that there's something very wrong. And of course, there's no spoilers in this show, so I'm not going to talk
Oh,
about
no, we're
what
not
the
telling
evidence
what's
is.
wrong.
Yeah,
Don't
but
have to. Don't.
I think the reader has more of a sense of what's going on than Maggie and Lorimer. He's forbearing. He's obviously got a lot on his plate with his work. But I think they're both glad to see the back of her, to be quite honest. And, of
Yeah.
course, he goes down to the funeral in London. It's an interesting one, a really interesting one.
Well, Cheryl has to tell you that she thought Maggie was insane to accept and feel compassion for the ex-girlfriend. I don't know if anybody else would have really cared and been so compassionate. And, yeah, I know. She sort of took over the house, too. I mean, you know, bring me this
She did
and
a
do
bit,
that.
yep.
And a little spoiled person. So what happens when she goes home and calls Bill to come to her flat? And what happened and what does she expect him to do about it? I mean, Maggie should have, you know, hightailed it with her and played the Jessica Fletcher angle there.
Yeah, but you've got to remember that, you know, Maggie's got her job as well. She's a high school teacher.
Yeah.
She can't just drop everything and go.
Yep.
You know, there are these constraints on our everyday lives. And I do try to make it seem as if these are real people with everyday lives. They've got to follow particular, you know, particular paths. They can't just drop everything and run to follow the plot of my story.
I know, as an educator for 1,000 years too, you can't always drop everything. As a matter of fact, a couple of times I had some tough classes and I was absent for a whole half hour, and my principal called me and said, we're on the way to get you because no one can control them. I go, huh? And yeah, so I know. So what is he doesn't take the case. Why does he assign it to DCI Wilson? Who I like too.
Well,
you have to keep him in the book.
Sorry, why doesn't he just assign it, did you say?
Why didn't Larimer take the case? How come he assigned, you know, the case of the guy's death to DCI Wilson? Why did he want him to take care of it?
If there's a conflict of interest,
yeah,
you shouldn't really be handling something that impinges so closely to you. So that was one reason. Of course, he's also senior investigating officer with this terrorist threat. So he's pretty much got his hands full. And as a senior investigating officer, you have to learn to delegate to your other senior officers.
Yeah, I know. But he's pretty good, this guy.
Oh, he's
and
pretty good. And he's going places, I can tell you.
Well, okay, that's good, because now I know you're not killing him off. This is good. We hope not. And, you know,
oh,
I've said that
not
to other...
No, he's going to be meeting quite a lot of very, very tricky situations in the next few books, Fran. But no, he's not going to get killed off. I will be going up to heaven before Lorimer does.
Well, you're not going anywhere because, after all, who would keep me entertained and from a foreign country? Everybody gets excited when I tell everybody that Alex Ray is calling in from Scotland. I go like, yeah, this is good.
Oh,
okay, good.
Oh, that's sweet.
And
thank
like,
you.
You're talking to somebody. Yeah, I did an interview with somebody from Japan. Now that was hard because I had to do the interview at 8 o'clock in the morning here because it's 9 o'clock there. So I was half awake, but that's okay. So we have a lot of dead bodies in this book. Which is okay.
You do,
what and where
actually.
Is the first? Yeah, we have a couple. What and where is the first killing, and where is the body found? And there's a young girl that's going to tell us about her. Poor thing.
Well, there's a woman found out in the countryside, a black woman, and she's got a partial tattoo, and she's got. You know, there's nothing to identify this woman. So she's in the city mortuary, and she's got a post-mortem. They know that she's been murdered, but they don't know who this woman is. And the whole thing about the tattoo is part of a clue as to what her identity might be. And it was very interesting. I went to a real tattoo parlor. I don't have any tattoos, as it happens, so I'd never been to a tattoo parlor. The chap who owned the tattoo parlor agreed to let the parlor and himself be real places and the real person in the book. And it really was very, very interesting. So when you read the sections in the book, this is a real place in Glasgow, and that is a real person in Glasgow. And, you know, I sat there and watched people being tattooed, and the whole thing was explained to me. And it was absolutely fascinating. And some months later, when I'd written the book and it was submitted to the publisher, I was walking down one of the main streets in Glasgow, and I met the chap in the street and said, hello. It was the most surreal thing. I thought, I've just met a character in my book. You know, it's funny. Once or twice people have agreed to be themselves in my book, and this chap did as well, Terry's tattoo studio. It was such fun, but that's the first victim, and that there are other victims along the way, as you quite rightly say.
I guess the thought of a tattoo makes me hurt, makes me go ow.
Sorry. Hello.
I would be petrified to see a tattoo like that. Oh my God. Didn't bother you to watch them do it?
No, it was quite interesting. I've got quite a strong stomach. It didn't really bother me. And the young lady who was getting the tattoo, she had a lot of beautiful butterflies and flowers all down her back already.
Mm.
And she didn't seem to be bothered by it. It looked very artistic. But we've talked about the terrorist threat, and we've talked about Lorimer's personal involvement in this book. But the third strand, in some ways, was the most important, wasn't it, Fran? The whole aspect about human trafficking. And the first body with the tattoo, of course, is involved in that, although at the time of the discovery of that body, the reader has no idea that that's what it's linked to.
That's what's scary, because a lot of the books that I've been reading are based on human sex trafficking, and it's still a very big deal. They haven't been able to eliminate it just about anywhere. So we've got it's scary, because no matter what you do, it's everywhere.
It was very interesting. This is now 2018. I was writing that book, say, around about 2012, which is only 6 years ago, and there was almost nothing on the World Wide Web about human trafficking. There was almost nothing in the Sunday supplements, you know, the weekend newspapers. There was nothing. However, by the time the book was published, there was a bigger awareness in the media of human trafficking. And by that time, I was promoting the book, I could say to my audiences that human trafficking is the third biggest involved organized crime in the UK after drugs and guns. And it's everywhere now. You see it every single newspaper you lift, every single thing that you're looking at. Human trafficking's everywhere. And in fact, the book that I've just released, the 15th book in the series, which is called Only the Dead Can Tell, deals with a case in Scotland that actually had its own parallel in reality. And it was a joint operation between Scotland and Slovakia.
I'm very, very interesting. Read that one too.
Yeah. So that's just out.
I've read so many of them. One is called Abuse of Discretion by Pamela Samuel Zung. She's coming on next month. And Power Empire by Mark Cameron, a whole part of human sex trafficking. And Wolf in the Woods by Nancy Allen. It seems to be definitely this. I've read so much that I could probably write a book myself now, which I'm not.
Yes.
Yeah. On it. It's frightening. And to know that there are parents that actually sell their children into it to make money.
Sometimes they do.
And
It's
scary. I mean, I've read so much, and then there are parents that think that they're going to be in modelings or something, and then they sell these girls, and they have no
choice.
That's right.
So I follow the story of a very young girl who is taken from Nigeria. That's one of the three main places that human traffickers target. Eastern Europe, Nigeria, and Vietnam are the three big places that they source these poor young girls from. So I followed this girl's story, if you like, how she was taken from her village with great promises made, of course, you know, and from an impoverished area, and how she was brought to Glasgow. And she has no English. She doesn't speak English. She's never learned to speak English. And in some ways, she was a silent one of the silent games. The original title in the UK was The Bird That Did Not Sing. We have a Glasgow motto, and it includes the bird that did not sing and the bell that did not ring, that kind of thing. So I had sort of played on our Glasgow motto for that, but it really meant, and you know, do you have the phrase in America about a singing bird, a stool pigeon, a grass?
Yeah.
You know, that somebody who tells the police what's happening in the underworld. So a singing bird. I had the same kind of connotation. Sometimes the titles of my books have several layers to them. And this is, in fact, what happened. So the silent games, there was a silence. This girl could not communicate verbally because she had no English. And she's been trafficked and taken to this cold country, Scotland, a grey city, Glasgow. So different from Africa. I lived in Africa for a time, so I knew what it was like, and the contrast is amazing.
So we have Gail and Cameron, right? So why do we know that Cameron is no good? I don't like him at all.
Well, you have quite a lot of people who are septs, that's S-E-P-T, of the Clan Gregor, the MacGregor clan. As you know, in Scotland we have all these different clans, but you have little subdivisions. And so different subdivisions of Gregor have different surnames, and this chap is one of them. And he is inveigled, I think that's quite a good way of putting it, he's inveigled to join this clandestine society, which is in fact a terrorist group, another far out terrorist group. Instead of having the usual Al-Qaeda, I thought, no, I'm going to have something that's homegrown. I'm standing the whole terrorist thing in its head. People's expectations tend to be Al-Qaeda. And I thought, no, let's make it different. Let's make it actually Scottish people who are very anti-royalist, pretty much Republican, completely disaffected, and to be quite honest, a wee bit mad. One of them is at least a bit bonkers, if not obsessed. And I just thought that was a bit of fun. And to get the whole thing into perspective, at the very beginning, you see an Australian, an elderly Australian man and his wife coming over for the Commonwealth Games. And it's a big deal for him, and he's really looking forward to it. And who turns out to be his guide but this young man, whom he does not know is part of this terrorist group. And he is unwittingly involved in their plot. And, you know, there you have this dichotomy of something very sinister and something very innocent together, appearance and reality. The young man seems to him to be a perfectly nice student type, but in fact, underneath it all, he's using this elderly Australian for his own purposes. I think it's quite a nasty thing that he does. And of course, he's got his girlfriend, as you know, who works for the Commonwealth Games, and he's only been using her to get an inroad in, and an insight into the goings-on.
That is so scary. So we've got the men. This is interesting and very clever, so that we don't know who anybody is. The men behind the attacks, how come you only identified them by numbers? That was really interesting,
well,
because nobody knows who they are.
That's because the person who was in charge didn't really want them to give each other, to talk to each other by name. If you can't identify somebody, you can't tell the police or the authorities who they are. So I kept it as sinister and as tense as I possibly could, for these reasons, and made them almost like faceless people, although I do describe their, you know, their physical appearance.
Mm-hmm.
But I just thought it was a little bit more dramatic.
It was. Now, when somebody does something wrong and they get upset, this is a very interesting way of putting it. What do they mean when someone is deselected? And I wouldn't want to be deselected as a book reviewer.
Yeah, well, if they're deselected, they're no longer to be in this particular group. They're off they go. It doesn't mean that they're assassinated.
Yeah.
they're just shown the door. You know, they're just told, no, I'm sorry, you can no longer be part of this, and that's it. And because they don't know names, they can't protest, they can't get back to them, and they change the venue for their meeting place all the time. So there's no one headquarters for this group. So if they were deselected, well, that's their tough luck. You know, there's nothing they can do about it.
That is so scary. So when the first young girl and then another are found, why did they determine that maybe they're sex slaves? When did they finally realize that it's sex trafficking? Because they don't put it together so fast.
Sorry, could you say that again? I didn't quite catch what you said.
Yeah. When does Lorimer and the police realize that it's sex trafficking or sex slaves? When do they finally put it all together?
I think, I don't want to spoil anything, but another body discovered, and they realize that the first girl that they found, they find her ethnic origin, and they have suspicions that she may have been brought into the country because she's got no identity. They have suspicions that she may have been brought into the country for this particular purpose. So there has been a thought, there has been a suspicion about that.
Mm.
And of course, when the second body is found, that confirms it. And when the flat is raided, they discover that too. But I think from the first body being found, that was always an indicator.
Well, let's get back to that evil witch, Vivian. they can wait. How does Rosie determine the death of these girls? And when Vivian's husband is dead, she says it's poison. And Vivian just, I don't like Vivian.
Oh, she's too sweet to be wholesome, as my mammy would have said.
Yeah, I know.
She's very beautiful. She's an actress. And, of course, you've got to remember this, the whole thing about being an actress and its appearance and reality. Is she really what she seems to be? And, of course, you've sussed her out. You're a great reader and you're a writer as well. So, you know, you're getting under her character quickly, which is great. But to get back to Rosie, what the pathologist will do is to send samples for toxicology, and it will be the forensic toxicologist who will test all these samples and come back and say, you know, these are the traces that have been found in the bloodstream, and this determines X, Y, Z. And so that they find that the, you know, it's not been a what they thought was a straightforward heart attack. And again, it's appearance in reality. What seems to have been a man dying of a heart attack under stress is something quite other. But of course, your country and my country will be exactly the same. The Crown Prosecution Service, in any sudden death, will say it has to be a post-mortem examination. You can't just say, oh, poor man died of a heart attack, and that's it, we'll release his body for burial. Doesn't happen. Sudden death has to be investigated.
I know, it's scary. And sometimes they don't exactly get it all the time, but you never know. So, we've got, how do we know that she wants to remain? This really got me because at this point, Maggie should have taken a shovel and shoved her out because she doesn't, I mean, seriously, that would have been me and that would never happen. And so how do we know that she wants to remain living in Bill's house? And how would you know she manages to take over like she's the wife or something? Seriously, she's got a serious issue here.
She's shown both hospitality and she's shown compassion. And it's only as she only stays there for as long as she needs to stay there until she can go back home to you know, to her own place in London. So I suppose Maggie realises that this is only for a time. You know, she's not going to be there forever. So Maggie shows her patience, she shows her forbearance, but more than anything, she shows her sympathy. And I can't imagine what it must be like to be confronted with a woman who has so suddenly lost her husband like this. She's away from home, she's away from friends and family. She's just organised a school reunion, for goodness sake. And then the very night after the school reunion, this happens to her. Who does she turn to? She turns to somebody that she knows. She turns to Lorimer. And she'd been speaking to him that very night. And in a lot of ways to Maggie, it probably made sense. But here was somebody she knew who was also a senior policeman. So when you think about it logically, it would be quite natural for Vivian to have done this. And Maggie probably appreciates that, okay, she's turned to Bill for help. She doesn't know very many other people in the city. And why not turn to someone who's a senior police officer? That's the very person who can surely help her. So when you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. And when you think about Maggie, she would be very hard-hearted not to show a newly bereaved woman sympathy, a woman who seems to be utterly in shock and completely devastated by this turn of events.
Well, Maggie, the part I like was is that Maggie expresses her thoughts to herself because she really, in her heart, knows that there's something's not right there. So then she feels guilty for them. I wouldn't, you know, she was right the first time. And then Vivian Thames asks, I won't say what, Lorimer a question, and thank God he came to his senses. So she realizes it. So Maggie is smart and senses something off. So how does she determine this, and why doesn't Vivian like the cat, who's such a cute little cat? She doesn't like and the cat. Doesn't
ah,
like
no.
Either.
You
smart
see,
cat.
I love cats. And this is me saying, you don't like cats? There's something wrong with you if you don't like cats.
Yeah. I got two next door to me, my best pal.
Yeah. Oh, so it's just somebody who doesn't like Chancer. I'm thinking, how can you not like Chancer? It must be something wrong with you if you don't like the cat. So it was just, it was a wee bit of fun on my part, I suppose. But it was showing her distaste for cats or her fear of the cat. And I'm thinking, no, that just underlines that she's not a very sympathetic person. Maggie obviously mistrusts her, but on the other hand, she feels that she's got to, I suppose, put up and shut up for a certain length of time. And, of course, it's a great relief when they know that she's going to be leaving and going back down to London. I think it was a great big collective sigh of relief after that.
Well, Lorimer has a problem, a big one. First, he has to find who killed Charles. Then he has to find who he killed the girls. How does he manage to get all of that done? And who does he rely on? I felt like so bad for this guy. He's like torn And, of course, there's a superior above him, too. So he's going to want, that person's going to want, actually, both of them solved at the same time.
That's right. It can be very, very tricky. And it's really awful for senior officers when they've got that kind of workload on their plate. You know, people say, gosh, you know, policemen retire so early. They've got their 30-year service. You know, they can be young retirees. They've got an easy life. And it's not like that at all. The very first senior police officer who helped me with my research, I think he only lived about a year and a half after his retirement. He died when he was about 53 of heart complications.
Wow.
And, you know, senior police officers are under huge stresses.
Mm-hmm.
Crime doesn't keep a timetable. Crime doesn't take a holiday. And there will be times where senior officers are thrown really bad numbers on the dice, if you like. And they've got one big case that they're doing and something else comes along. They have to delegate. They have to look to their own team. They have to spread themselves as thinly as they possibly can. Sometimes their resources are finite. But we're lucky in Scotland that we have a lot of different resources to call on. We've now got the Scottish Police Crime Campus, Gart Cosh. We've got a terrific forensic service. And, of course, Lorimer's always got Solly, Solomon Brightman, who is Professor of Psychology. Yeah. And he does criminal profiling. So you have these things to hand. But it's not easy for him. It's certainly not easy for him, as you rightly point out.
Well, before I forget, believe it or not, Monday, I'm excited, John Lansing, the fourth gunman, on the 16th, One Petal in Time, it's a caregiver's book. It's really a true story. On the 17th, the author of The Fix. On the 18th, Alison the Assassin. On the 23rd, Alan Topol will be here with the Russian Resurgence. If there's anything you want to know about the Chechen War, Hungary, and North Russia, I can tell it to you by heart. And on the 26th, I am so excited, K.J. Howe, who runs the Philofest and who invited me to the Philofest, will be here with Skyjacked. And on the 1st of May, R.Z. Belsky, Yesterday's News. And on the 3rd, my favorite person in the whole universe, John Land, he's wrote, believe it or not, A Date with Murder, the Jessica Fletcher murders. He just wrote a brand new one. And on the 7th, my other favorite author, Brian Freeman, Alter Ego. And that's just some of what I'm up to. And I'm excited. On April 12th, Elias Cujo has invited, guess who, me, to be a guest on his show at 8:15. They're interviewing me. They're not telling me what they're asking either, to tell you the truth. And I'm going to be talking about A Daughter's Promise. So that's just some of coming up. So this is good practice. So listening to how you answer so I don't get nervous. This is the second time I'm doing live radio on an AM station. So we have another character that I love, Kirsty. And how does she help? I love this girl. And she needs to move up in the police department. This kid's smart. She's smarter than everybody else.
Kirsty is
a
favorite character
of
mine.
She's so cool.
Yeah, I like Kirsty.
How did you create her?
Well, Kirsty came into being in the book called The Swedish Girl. And The Swedish Girl is a book where Kirsty is actually a student in Glasgow. And she discovers that the girl who owns the flat where she lives, she discovers her murdered. And things go from bad to worse. And Kirsty actually decides that she's going to do a little bit of amateur sleuthing. And in the end, Kirsty, like Lorimer before her actually, she gives up her course at university and decides that she's going to join the police. Now, her father is Alistair Wilson, who is one of Lorimer's detective inspectors on his team. So she's got a dad in the cops already. So then you see Kirsty going through the ranks. She goes away to study at the police college. She goes through the years where she has to be a uniformed police officer. And then you'll see her in this book, in The Silent Games, helping to investigate this murder. And it's actually Kirsty who goes to the tattoo parlor. She's really quite involved in this case.
Now we've got two girls. We've got Asa and Shireen. Tell us about
Asa, right. And
why does she want to protect Shireen? And why was Shireen, and who was Shireen, and why does she want to protect this young girl? And this is what always bothers me when I'm reading these books. These people take these girls, and they want to use them for what they want to use them, and yet they abuse them just to shut them up or whatever.
Shireen is actually quite like a madam in a brothel. And she's been paid to look after these young Nigerian girls who have been trafficked. And Asa is a 15-year-old Nigerian girl who, as I say, speaks no English. But there is something about her that Shireen, I suppose, brings out the motherly side in her. She's doing this to earn money. You know, Shireen's supposed to be hard-nosed, hard-hearted, but she in fact does feel protective towards this girl. She knows that she's being exploited.
That's so scary. So then they think, well, the girls are killed, but one girl commits suicide. So how does that change their outlook and their outlook to try and find Asa?
That does. That completely changes things. Shireen, I think she becomes very, very afraid, and I think she probably realizes that she is in a life and death situation. She's mixed up with very, very bad people. And it's at that point that she decides to liberate Asa, and she and Asa go off together. And they take flight, and they really are in grave danger.
Let's go back to those attacks. You know, I go to the Philofest every year, and then there are thousands of people that come into this place. And you wonder sometimes what's going to happen. And last year, in the middle of the night, I heard people on the floor. There was a protest outside. And I was like, oh, God, you got to be kidding me. And I found out, I won't say which organization. There was a big protest all night right down by the Grand Hyatt Hotel and all through Manhattan. And it got really loud. And then people tried to break into the hotel, but they caught them. And it was like, I came to relax. I didn't come to get nervous. And when I came down in the morning, the people at the hotel told me what happened. I was like, it could happen anywhere. We were just lucky that it was just that. So what was the purpose of the attacks, and what were they trying to prove? Because they were against the government, right? They didn't like the way they were being treated.
That's right. What they were trying to do was completely anti-royalist. If they were going to blow up the Commonwealth Games, it would have been a huge mark against the establishment. And the establishment, of course, is the royal family. And it's what Britain stands for. And they were completely against that. They wanted to reinstate something that was just completely different. They were against the whole way of life in Britain. They would want to set up a republic. You know, they were cranks, if you like. You know what I mean by a crank? People who were really obsessed. They wanted to overthrow and revolutionize the whole country. And sometimes you get people like that who have grandiose ideas, and they carry them out on almost no more than a whim. And we're seeing this again and again and again. But the rabble-rouser, the ringleader, if you like, he manages through his charisma to persuade these other people to join him. He has somebody who's an expert with bombs, somebody who's got an inroad into the Commonwealth Games, you know, people that he can use, and he infiltrates them, and he gets them and lures them into his clandestine society. Why does he want to do it? I suppose it's a kind of madness. A far, far more political madness than ordinary people can understand. But you do get these people with mad, crazy ideas, don't you? More often than you can believe in this world.
Well, think about what happened in Parkland, and my niece's school was part of that. They were locked down for the whole time. It was horrible. As a matter of fact, what happens is I text them every morning, my both nieces that go to school in Florida, to make sure they're okay. And
yeah.
Now my nephew moved to another state, and I text him every morning, are you okay? I'm getting crazy. I try to explain to them, I know that you're in a different state. I know it's not a foreign country, but once in a while you got to tell everybody that you're okay. So
yeah.
we've got Charles.
We live in a dangerous world, and we live in a world where there are dangerous and mad people with crazy ideas.
And they justify themselves even worse.
And I think this character in my book, he justifies his own actions because he believes that he is part of a bloodline of a particular clan, and this clan should be dominant, and it's very anti-royalist.
It's scary. So we've got Charles, and we've got the dead man Charles and his company, and he has a theatrical company. So
yes.
and you know, I couldn't understand why did she cancel all of it when he had somebody that could have run it and there was a lot of money. So why did she cancel it, miserable person?
I think she was frightened that this money was just going down the drain. And of course, you know, she's married to Charles. This was her livelihood.
Mm-hmm.
She saw this money disappearing.
Yeah.
And she thought, no, you know, but she of course Things were happening that we, the reader, don't actually know until much later what really Charles is up to with this theatrical society, particularly the overseas elements that he's bringing into the country.
That's scary. We won't say who he's bringing in. I just crossed out that question.
Yeah.
Because we're not going to tell them. So now we have Lorimer, and all of a sudden something's happening where people know what he's doing. How were they able to hack into his security system? And how does he realize it?
Well, the police can do these kind of things, of course. And, you know, we are lucky enough to have experts behind the scenes. One of the places that I did visit through Police Scotland was the anti-terrorist group. And it was very, very interesting how they work hand in glove with MI6. Things that we never know that are actually happening can always remain a secret. You know, we sleep in our beds safely at night because of people who are out there working on our behalf, infiltrating what they call cells, terrorist cells. But we might never know that these things are happening. And I have to say, in Police Scotland, they have very, very, very good experts who work with the anti-terrorist groups. And as I say, our security systems are not bad. And that's an understatement. They're pretty good.
I wish they were as well every other place, too. It's scary. I mean, I don't know. I read a lot on Google. I get the alerts for everything, and including snow and rain and fog and hurricanes. And seriously. And when I saw that about 3 weeks ago, I was at an urgent care, and this lady walked in and she said, "They just closed down all the schools in your area, in this area," and I was right across the street from the school. And I said, "Oh, that's good. It's time to get out of here." And it was that this guy, it was scary, this guy, they thought it was a terrorist attack, but it wasn't. It was a guy that was mad at his girlfriend and killed her. And he got away with it. They never found him. They closed every single school, locked down, they were going to close down the urgent care too, because they were afraid, and they never caught him. He just got
that's
away with
dreadful.
It.
That's dreadful. Dreadful.
It's scary. So what happened?
That's a good thing about being a crime writer, Fran. We don't let our bad guys get away with it. And in our books, we always get them. Agatha Christie always did this. In fact, one of her books was entitled Nemesis. And Nemesis really was the mythical goddess of the fates who always caught up with the bad guys, you know. Your nemesis, your fate, whatever it was called. And I think that's one of the satisfying things. We can't change the way our world is. We can't right the wrongs that we see every day. But in our own stories, we can make sense of our own situations. We create a small world in our own crime novels. And we give our readers this sense that justice will be done. And I think that's one of the things that is satisfying about being a crime writer. And I'm sure you feel the same, being a crime writer or a crime reader. You do get this sense of satisfaction that justice will be done.
You have no idea how many I've read. And in the last couple of weeks, I actually read a few where I won't say who, where the bad guy's going to come back again in a couple of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, yeah. Well, if you ever read Iris Johansson, a lot of times the bad guy, you think he get away with it, but he's not. And I'm now reading J.A. Jantz, A Duel to the Death, and I didn't realize that the guy that was one of the people in the other book is back in this one. I go like, huh? And it's good. It's scary. I'm doing a panel show on that, and I hope that you're better. Maybe you'll be better by then. June 4th, and we're going to talk about endings. How you create an ending and how your villain sometimes dominates the ending. And I'm doing that with three authors because I like doing things that are different. I get bored easily. So
yeah, that's really interesting. I did a workshop quite recently on endings, and it's very important to get an ending right, isn't it?
Yeah, not everybody does. So what happens when Vivian is alone with the gardener? We have about five more minutes, a little bit more.
Sorry, what was your question?
What happens when Vivian is alone with the gardener?
When Vivian is alone with the gardener, the gardener actually sees her, or she tries to make it out as if she's doing some gardening work. Can you imagine this beautiful girl doing some gardening work? Not really. And, you know, he's a bit suspicious about this. And later on, it's the little pussycat that's scratching in the garden, and it's the gardener who discovers that she's not, in fact, gardening. She's burying something.
Yeah, we know something, but not telling what. So,
nope.
I just crossed out another question. What happens that Lorimer realizes that every time she summons him or calls, Maggie should knock her out?
Every time she summons him, what was that you said?
Well, that she really wants more than he's willing to give. She's after
something. Oh, yes. I mean, he's quite aware that she is a siren. You know, she's putting out all these feelings for him. And he'll go so far to be a gentleman, to be comforting her, but he's not going to go any further than that. He will put up a barrier. He'll be nice. He'll be polite, but he's not going to succumb to her charms. He's older now. He's wiser now. He's got the woman he wants, and it certainly isn't Vivian.
Thank God, because I would have been very upset, and I would have had to write you a letter and tell you rewrite the ending, or rewrite the whole thing. No.
Oh, no. Oh, no. He's a sensible man.
We realize that Charles's murder is suspect, but we won't say, you know, who we think did it. But chapter 57 kept me nervous. It's explosive. It brings it out in the open as they try to stop what the terrorists started. How did you create that without giving away the ending? That was scary, let me tell you.
With great difficulty. Do you know, when you get to that part of a book, it's like you're holding the reins of eight galloping horses and they're all charging ahead. And it's a very, very difficult thing to do. You know, you're showing a little bit, but you're not telling. And you're just easing in, but because you're heightening the tension all the time. And that was really quite a difficult thing to do, was to gather it all and make it really tense and really emotive as well, without giving anything away, and keeping it as much to the end as possible.
I didn't have the faintest idea what you were going to do. Usually I figure out, I'd go like, wait a minute.
Oh, good.
So
it worked then. Hooray.
It did. It worked.
Thank
you. Like, what is she going to do now? And who is what really happened to Charles? And I go like, wait a minute. Oh, my God. And I think the people, the one involved, or the whoever it was like, huh? I think the person that you was surprised. So what is next for Lorimer and Maggie? And the question at the end was, this was hilarious, because she's so smart. You think she's going to quit teaching and become a police officer?
Maggie?
Yeah.
Is Maggie going to become a police officer? No, Maggie.
Yeah, she's got the skills. She's got the skills,
right? She's got lots of skills. You'll have to wait for a few books to find out just what Maggie does next. But the next book in the series that follows the Silent Games is called Keep the Midnight Out. And Maggie and Lorimer go off to the most beautiful Hebridean island, the island of Mull, for a quiet, restful holiday. Or so they think.
They've tried that before and they failed. I guess they're never going to get it. Oh, it's so sad. But it wouldn't be a mystery if they didn't have a problem, right? It wouldn't be anything if it didn't have a problem. What I am doing right now, everybody that's listening, and I'm sure there are people listening that I don't know about, I just made the show go live. And no, I cut that out. Yeah. Because doing things on my phone works better sometimes than on my computer. So before we end, where can we learn more about you and your work and Keep Midnight Out? By the way, I emailed Cheryl, who's on the line, and I'm getting that one too. So don't worry. That book I'm going to post May 31st. And,
good.
Should you be okay? I'm not doing any shows after June 6th because, like I said, my nephew is graduating high school on June 19th, and he's requested me to yell in the stands and embarrass him and do all sorts of things because that's just me. And you've got to keep it lively, otherwise what's the point of being, you know, the aunt? But if for any reason you're okay by then, just let me know and I can put you in for an interview on the 31st if you're okay.
Super.
I see. That's only for you. I wouldn't do it for anybody else.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Okay, so where can we find out more about all of your books? And everyone that hasn't read them from the beginning, what are you waiting for? I mean, seriously.
Well, if you look me up on the internet, my web address is alex-gray, G-R-A-Y, .com. And you can see my website there. Or you can follow me on Twitter, and my Twitter handle is Alex in Crimeland. Think Alice in Wonderland, but Alex in Crimeland, all lowercase, all one word.
I'm going to have to do. Are you on Facebook too, or no?
I'm on Facebook too. Yeah.
I'll have to find it because I'm on Facebook also, and
good.
So on if I get any more on Facebook, I don't even know anymore. If I get any more on Facebook. But I want to thank you very much.
Out there. Thank you.
And I wish you well. And I just hope you get better real fast. And
thank you so much. Bless you.
You're welcome. Everybody from America to Scotland, she's got the sun. She brought me the sun today, which is fantastic. And I am so excited. I'm trying to figure out which one is yours. I don't know which one is it. There's like 5,000 Alex Grays on here. I'm going to have to search. I don't know which is which. There's one Alex Gray. There's one that's definitely not this one, and it's definitely not the one in New York City. I'll find it. If you don't,
very good.
You can find me. Okay. Everybody,
excellent.
Have a great day. Thank you so much, Alex. Get better soon, and bye.
Thank you, Fran. Bless you, everybody. Bye.